This is Behind the Docs, the show that shines a spotlight on the people shaping how we understand and use technology. In each episode, we pull back the curtain to talk about what it's really like to create the docs we all rely on. Let's dive in. Welcome to Behind the Docs. We have a very awesome guest here today. I'm super excited for this conversation. But behind the scenes, we've had to reschedule a couple of times. So it's even added to the anticipation. It's been awesome. So we're finally here and I'm really excited. Danielle Washington, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ren. I am very excited. The anticipation has been building for me.
Absolutely. Me too. So, okay, let's just jump right into it. Tell our audience who you are and where, how you came into TechCom. Like, what's your backstory?
Yeah, my name's Danielle Washington. I've always been writing. I literally at like in high school, I had a blog. Like, who was doing that back in like 2009?
I was.
Well, that's why we're talking. We're in perfect company.
Totally.
I got into like technical writing. First, I was like writing test reports for an electrical testing company. And so like the hardware side of things. And then I went over to HPE, a Fortune 500 company, writing up documentation for their GreenLake platform. And I have been here ever since.
Yeah, so it sounds like you kind of found yourself writing technical documentation. What were your original plans for your career and how did you end up, you know, in the technical writing space at all?
I didn't know what I wanted to do with my career because like I went to boarding school. You know, in high school they always ask you like what you want to be.
Yeah.
I never really had an answer. I just knew I wanted to have fun. I knew I wanted to have fun. When I went into university, I started out at Howard where I was an advertising major. And then I was at an alum event for my boarding school, and I met someone who was working in international studies, international relations. So again, I've always loved writing. I've always loved words and languages. And he was talking about how he was like working for the State Department and he was learning so many languages. And I'm like, I want to do that. I really like that. So then I transferred schools and like I was in DC. So I went across town to American University and I did political science. I was also very interested in fashion. So again, completely different, like completely different. And then I just, yeah, once I graduated university, then I went to study abroad or not. I did study abroad, in the UK, but once I graduated, I went to Spain to teach English. And I realized I kind of like teaching. I didn't like necessarily teaching primary school, but I knew
Fair.
I liked to teach. So then after that, like I've done so many different things. I ran a candle and home fragrance company. And I think that's the thing that helps me the most now is like because it was a product and it was narrative based. So all of my scents, the entire company was based off of scents and like destinations. So I'd come back from Spain and I was like, I really miss Mallorca. I really miss Morocco. And so I wanted to build scents that were around those destinations, but it's very hard to get people to buy those things if they haven't been there, don't really have that connection to it. And also, if you can, you know, peruse, everyone loves going to Home Goods and smelling the candles there, and they're like $10. So it's very easy to like, oh, this smells great. I'm taking this home. It's very different than seeing something on your screen where you may not have been, you don't really have the connection, and it's like $45. So you really got to get good at telling the stories. And so I think the thing that's helped me the most, like where I am now, is back then I identified like what I needed to tell the customer in order to help them guide them along in making the decision to buy my product.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a like diverse background, but I love that so much. It's so common, and like everyone's diversity within how they got to technical writing is different, but like it truly, it feels like, you know, everyone had a totally different interest, and then something happened in their life and they were like, oh, technical writing could really be a move for me, and then they fell into it and they loved it.
That's definitely what happened for me. I was at one point interested in cybersecurity, so I remember learning things and looking at documentation, and my biggest gripe was that it only told me what would happen when things went right. It never told me what would happen if things went wrong. And so I started writing up my own walkthroughs on things, and that's really kind of how I fell into it, because I realized that I liked writing these things up for me, but I was also sharing them, and people seemed to really enjoy it, and they said it helped them, and that's definitely also what helped me get to HPE.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about HPE. Were you on a team of writers? Were you the only writer? What did that look like when you got there?
Yeah, when I got there, I was the first and only technical writer on the platform team. With big companies like that, they did have writers, but they were in other sections, so it's pretty siloed. I had to make a real effort to speak to the other writers and get them to know that I existed on my team, which that was really fun to be like, "Hey, wait, there's so many of us here." But on my team, I was embedded into an engineering team, and it was only me for quite some time. And that was, I had to get really good at, the system and knowing this. I can't write everything. I had to learn that very quickly, was that I cannot write everything. So that meant that I had to look at the system and figure out, okay, what developer is coming here first, and we need to make sure that the documentation for the people that'll be here first, that is written, and then we can focus on all of the other things after that.
Yeah, that's a like really good note. And I'm sure as someone who's first on the team, you know, you look at a giant project and think, oh, I want to tackle it all. But how do you determine? I'm sure you've, you know, encountered many projects since then. So how do you determine what's the first thing to tackle when you see a new project or you're given a new assignment?
Usually, I think about what is the most high impact and what is our end goal. I like to think of the ending first. How are we measuring success for this? And then from there, I can kind of work my way backwards. So if the end goal is success and we want to ensure that we have lots of people signing up for our product or signing up for the software, then that means that our onboarding documentation needs to be amazing. That has to be the most important thing. I can get to the maintenance documentation later, but if the goal is for people to be signing up, we need to make that as seamless as possible. And so it's really just thinking about the last part first for me.
Yeah, that makes total sense. You were talking earlier about how you started writing documentation for yourself, essentially, and then other people started using it. And something that I noticed on your online presence is that you say you build tools for things that you see missing. And so it sounds, I'm curious to understand the ethos behind that and how that has been a through line through your career.
Yeah, I am a very hands-on person. I am a hands-on learner. I love being on engineering teams because that allows for me to test things, because I want to test the whatever we're building. I want to test it to see if whatever the SME told me and the engineer told me about how it works, I need to see that for myself, because I don't have all of, the ins and out. I'm not in the weeds like they are, so I need to see it for myself. And so me testing it, then I can see if there's any gotchas. I can see if there's anything missing that they, may not have accounted for and that they may not be thinking about. And so that has really been the through line for me. It's just testing things and trying it out for myself, because anyone can write something, but if you don't test it, you don't know if it actually works the way you say it does. We hope that it works that way, but how do we know? I'm very inquisitive like that.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, you were saying earlier that you wanted to know what went wrong. And I'm sure that like you were not the only person who felt that, you know? And like it's so, and you would only get that kind of insight if you were testing your own documentation. And I think that that's a really like great thing for people to take away from this conversation. But moving on, I'm curious because one of the whole reasons why we wanted to talk, or I wanted to talk to you, was some of the work that you've been doing more recently. And so tell me a little bit about, you know, what your experience at HPE and beyond, like what got you to today and where are you today?
Yeah, so after HPE, I went to Weaviate, which is a vector database. And that was so much fun. I worked on all of our deployment documentation. So that is really how you deploy Weaviate on like your Kubernetes clusters. If you're deploying it in the cloud, like Weaviate Cloud, if you're like however you want to run it. Like, so that was really fun. And then after that, now I am at 10A Labs where I am working on some documentation for an information retrieval system and how that works. So this has all been a lot of fun. I've really been getting into the weeds with AI, and so I've been having the time of my life.
Yeah, as a curious person, I imagine that going from product documentation to like vector database documentation, like what was that transition like? Were you already kind of interested? Had you already learned, or did you end up learning on the job?
A little bit of both. So at HPE, I was on the platform team. So we did a lot of things with Kubernetes and we did a lot of EKS stuff. So I already, in DevOps, I already had that knowledge. And so I was able to take that to Weaviate and write about our deployment documentation because that was for that type of audience. And so I was able to, you know, it was like my tool bag. So I had new tool. I had the tools that I had from HPE. And while I was at Weaviate, I gained more tools and learning about AI infrastructure and, you know, the vector database being essentially the backbone of search. So it and gaining more tools. And now where I'm at now at 10A Labs with the information retrieval systems, I can kind of take all of that and put that into what I'm doing.
Cool. That's awesome. I am going to ask this question because when I was reading it on your profile, I didn't totally follow because I'm not a technical person. And so I'm really interested to know more about your EKS configurator. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so when I was at Weaviate, I one of the biggest things that I like to do in any role is to speak to the people around me because in my mind everything really is connected, and especially as a technical writer. So I had ongoing meeting cadence with our support engineers as well as our sales engineers, just finding out the things that they were seeing in the field, like what support tickets they were getting when they're onboarding customers, what things are they talking about, what things are they, you know, getting tripped up on. And constantly it was about configuring EKS and knowing how many nodes, knowing how exactly to do these things. Because again, as a deployment, like writing for the deployments, this was something that's like super important because you need to have you're not wanting to, you don't want to do it manually. You need to automate these things. And it just does not work in production if like someone's going into the AWS management console and you're like, yeah, okay, I'll add this many nodes. It just doesn't work like that. It's not a great use of your time. So finding out from the support team and the sales team, like, hey, these are things that people constantly are running into. I went through our documentation to see what information we had out there already. And so I rewrote our like self-managed EKS documentation. I wrote up that guide and that was great. It, you know, I had scripts in there and that was great, but still there people were still getting hung up on things. So I'm like, okay, it's not it's not a word problem. These are not things that, can be solved with more words because the answer is going to vary from person to person. So people need to have a way in order to say, okay, I need this many notes. This is what I'm doing. And they needed to have a way to make the decisions. So I decided, okay, well, we can create a configurator that allows for people to put in exactly what they need, and then it renders out the YAML files so that they don't have to get. YAML is very, the syntax of YAML, it's very fickle. And one extra space, and you're like trying to debug, and you're like, what is going wrong? So you want some, again, something that's repeatable and easy. So I figured that doing a configurator would be the best way in order to help people and not bombard them with more words that they may or may not be reading.
Yeah, that's incredible. So you basically took documentation and made a tool instead. And what were the results that came out of that?
Unfortunately, the day that I was presenting it to our engineering team in order to get that, out there, we were all laid off. So,
Oh my God.
yeah, it wasn't fun. But if I were to, like, if I were still there, the things that I would be wanting to look at is a reduction in support tickets. I'd want to look and see if anyone would name that. Like, hey, I tried the configurator and it helped. I would be looking into the forum posts to see if, like, about this particular topic, if, like, the questions about it went down.
Got it. Got it. That makes total sense. That is probably the first time that I've ever heard people in a documentation space talking about tooling to like instead of words. And I think that is such a unlock in how we're moving and how we're going, especially with like, the way that agentic workflows are starting to infiltrate the documentation space and things like not everything can be solved with words. And I think that building some tools that actually do, like, what is the goal and how you get there is not necessarily pigeonholed into words or a tool or anything like that. So I love that you're thinking that way. And I hope that other people can start to think that way as well. Are you starting to see, like, in your circles and stuff like that, like, are people changing the way that they are talking about documentation or, especially in like this current ecosystem, like what are you seeing?
Yeah, I'm seeing people talk about agent-friendly docs and having tools to see if your documentation is agent-friendly and if an agent can read your docs. So I think it's great the way the industry is kind of shifting to not just being about words. I will say it was awesome because when I was at Weaviate, I was on the developer experience and education team. So that was kind of expected from us to not just like, even though I was a, technical writer, I also wanted to, again, I'm very curious. I like to get my hands dirty. So I wanted to see what that could look like instead of just having words or even making videos. Like, there's other ways that we can get people to where they need and want to go.
Absolutely. So tell me, I know at we hold on, I'm gonna back up. Absolutely. One of the people that we recently talked to, Dakari Carey, has been building out testing for documentation. So is Manny Silva. So that's really exciting. All of those episodes are available for anyone listening. But one of the things that really drew me to you was you had this blog that you wrote at Weaviate. And it was a really interesting framework that I want to talk about a little bit more. And it was your day zero to two kind of framework for documentation. So I probably botched that a little bit, and I'd love for you to talk more about it.
Yeah, oh man, that was such a great blog. So the day it's really like a product type of framework that I've since like adopted for documentation because I feel like the I believe that documentation is a product surface, so it's only right to have it within that framework. So the day zero, day one, day two framework, it's just about separating your users, readers, what have you, into these three different buckets. So your day zero people, they're evaluating. They don't know if it's right for them, so you want to give them information about how it works, like what it is. Day one, that's probably like in the case of Weavy 8, that's when they have put through like their first query. They've spun up their first like cluster and they're trying it out. They're testing it. They're not like fully invested, but they're there. Your day two people are the people who are in production. And so they need to know the troubleshooting. They're like, okay, I'm already invested. So what happens if I do this? Like, how far can I push this? So these are like your edge cases, your troubleshooting docs. So I think that it's a very powerful way to write your documentation, because again, when I spoke earlier about when you have big projects and you're thinking about the last part first, one of the things you're thinking about is, okay, who is this for and what bucket does this person fall into? And okay, if they are a day one person, I don't need to really be writing like what is it, because they already know what it is. They're testing it. And they also don't really need to have like in-depth troubleshooting guides. So that I think this framework, with the way that documentation and the industry is going, I think people might find a little more success in their writing when they're shifting to looking at things in this way.
Absolutely. We originally talked, and you said a phrase that I thought was really interesting. It was docs as a decision system. So does this framework fit into that, like what you were getting at with that phrase, and how can people implement it in their own, if they were a technical writer at a company right now listening, how could they start to implement that in their day-to-day?
Yeah, so this definitely ties into docs as a decision system, because again, each day, what decisions are people making on each day? And so when a person who's listening, if you're wanting to test this out, when you're thinking about your day zero customer, you need to think about what decisions are they making. Is their decision going to be, in my mind, your decision on day zero is, should I use this or not? And so you got to give them all the reasons why they should use it. Your decision on day one is, should I deploy this way? Should I deploy this with, if you're doing something in the cloud, should I deploy this with EKS? Should I deploy this with AKS? Or should I maybe use GKE? Those are like Amazon, Azure, and Google. Like, you're deciding which cloud you might want to use. Day two, it's like, okay, the decisions that you're making there, like, should I add another node? Should I implement horizontal scaling, or should I do things a different way? So as a writer, if you're thinking about the decisions that your readers and users are going to be making within this documentation, you can kind of answer the questions for them before they appear. And it gives a better developer experience, reader, user experience. It just gives a better experience all around, because it's a little more thoughtful than just saying, hey, here's a reference guide. But what's decisions? What am I going to make with this reference guide? What am I going to do with this?
Absolutely. Does that change the way that you the wording that you use in your documentation? Like, are you using more decision, like outcome-based wording? Or like, yeah, I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I'm using more outcome-based wording when I'm writing these things. I find that it's like, okay, if you want to do this, then do this. And it leaves little room for error, little room for, the gotchas. And especially as we get into more like agents looking at our documentation, because we know that the industry is shifting. Like, I can go in Claude Code and have it spin something up for me. And when it's reading the documentation of whatever software that I want it to use, it needs to know exactly what to do. I don't want it to like have room for error. It can't really ask questions of the author. It's gonna come up with its own scenario and say, okay, yep, this sounds good. And that's not a great experience for anyone. So again, the decisions that we want our readers, whether they're agents or machines, what we want them to do, I think that is super important to think about, especially with the way that the industry is changing.
Yeah, totally. Wow, there's like so much going on in my brain. This happens often, like right about this time in the conversation. I just am like, I have so many questions. So I'll give you some context. One of the things that I do at Heretto is help site assessments. So using the CODiE award criteria, we will review like documentation portals and that kind of stuff, and grade help sites. And I have done presentations on it, and a lot of the times people end up asking me, like, should we do X, Y, or Z or A, B, and C? And while there's always going to be like an industry preference, like a best practice, sometimes it really just depends on the user. And I actually fall back to that a lot, where it's like, the industry is going to say this, but talk to your users. And so in this process, it seems like I'm curious, how much are you actually talking to users versus just being able to go through and, make decisions, putting yourself in the place of a user?
I think because I'm testing things, I become the first user. And so I'm like user zero, and I try to, I'm thinking as a user because I am being the user, instead of just thinking about being the user. So I think it's a little bit of a shift. And again, you have to test things on your own. Like you have to like really get down and dirty and get into the weeds to see what people are going to be experiencing. Because yeah, the industry can tell you something, but that doesn't make it right for you. And that's with so many things in life. Like it may not make it right for you. So you Again, I'm a hands-on learner, so I like to test things out. I'm super curious. I like to test and tinker. I like to break things. And what's the process for putting it back together? I'm very, very curious in that way. You really have to like break the things because how do you know how strong it is? How do you know what things can withstand if you don't get in and like stress test it? Because that really mimics like the real world environment. Like if you're putting something in production and you haven't tested it, how do you know? Like how do you know? What if it's like I remember even for my candle company, like I had my website Black Friday sale. Like I just like recently redone my website. I had like some press and like things were great. I hadn't tested my servers. So
Did you go down?
I did.
Yeah.
And like, there were things that I didn't know because I never thought to test it. I'm like, the site looks beautiful. Like, that's all. The site looks beautiful. I've got my inventory. Everything's good. But oh no, I didn't
Yeah.
test what the real world conditions would look like. Everyone thinks about like, everyone wants to have all the success in the world, which is great. If you want lots of users to download your product and download your software, what's that going to look like for them? Like, if you get like 10 million people trying to download something all at once, can you handle that? You have to think about like, what does that actually look like? So.
Yeah. Although as a business owner, what a great problem to have, right?
I remember telling myself that, like, I have this huge sale, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. And previously, I thought, like, I'm gonna have $10,000 days. Like, why not? I had my first $1,000 day, and I'm like, oh my God, like, oh my God, this is a lot. Like, you have to think, like, and for a product-based business, you're thinking about all the products, all the things you have to make. You're like, wait, I didn't calculate what that would look like. And so when you're writing the documentation, when you're having software, you've really got to think about what it looks like and practically, not just how great it's going to feel. Like, what is it going to look like?
Absolutely. Sometimes as a marketer, this is a total aside, but I think about like utilizing your site going down as like a marketing ploy. Like, oh, we were just so popular that our site went down. So sorry, but it's back up and you can get what you want now. And like, it's, in the age of Taylor Swift taking down a whole Ticketmaster, I think like it wouldn't be a bad idea, but it'd be one trigger. You'd be able to pull it once and then you could never do
Yeah,
it
you
again.
can only do that once. And you're like, if you're like doing a sale, you're like, oh, you guys wanted our product so much that you broke the site. Guess what? Our sale's going to be extended for another couple of days to make sure you all can get what you want. So,
Absolutely. Yeah, but you can't do that like every quarter, like
no, you
absolutely
cannot.
not.
It's like a one-time like fire sale. Like, okay,
Exactly.
let's
It's like you have way too much product. Like, let's do it. Let's get it unloaded. Anyway, I was thinking about that. Like the marketing brain never turns off. Okay, so tell me, we mentioned AI earlier and we are in this new age where you basically can't have a conversation with like anyone without talking about AI. So talk to me a little bit about what you're really digging into right now and what's really exciting you in terms of AI, maybe even what's, making you upset.
So right now, what's exciting to me, I'm really like all in on information retrieval systems, but also like that's like a bigger part, but I've been digging back into vector databases. So I've just been digging into the database. It just holds the backbone in like the various different kinds of search. You know, you've got semantic search, hybrid search, vector search. There's so many things, and like I've been digging into models and excuse me, what models are doing what, and like what are they better for? Like, oh, should I try an open source model, or like we're all waiting for Anthropic's Mythos? Like, we're all waiting for that. Like, I'm really into models. I've really been into the databases and the different types of search. What's been getting on my nerves has been, I guess, kind of the fear mongering. And, you know, when you hear leaders speak about AI, of course, it's inevitable, but they're not speaking about it in a way that people who don't work in the industry are really gonna like. I mean, you can't really tell people, hey, everybody's going to use AI and you're all going to lose your jobs, and think that people are going to be excited about it. People will be like, no, AI must go. Like, so I've been getting a little irritated because, you know, on one hand, yes, it is inevitable. However, we need to communicate to people in a way that doesn't, you know, make people fearful about their livelihood. And I've also been annoyed with how AI is being the scapegoat for layoffs happening. Like, that's not, like, I don't think that AI specifically is the reasoning. And also the way people, I've got a few things that grind my gears.
We
Few
go
things
on
that.
and on about this one.
Yeah, like I think the way that some companies are adopting it, they just are completely foregoing security, completely foregoing governance. It's like that part of their brain is clicking off. They're like, AI, AI, AI. And it's like, okay, wait, there's still things that you need to do in order to do this safely. Like, that's just like foundational, just the principle. So yeah, those. Before I go on and on, those are the things that have been grinding my gears.
Yeah, I think that that governance piece is a really big one that we're talking about a lot because it's almost like this weird, I don't even know what to call it, like a double-edged sword where these companies are adopting AI and in doing so, they're laying off their technical writing team, which are the governors of all the things that you're going to need to make that AI work. And to make it work well. And so I'm really curious what it's going to look like in like a year when all these companies have laid off all their technical writers, and then they're just all their documentation's a mess, and they're going to have to bring back, content. It's going to, I guarantee you, we talk about it, we joke about it a bunch. And we don't joke because it's not funny, but there's going to be like a whole new wave of new titles, where it's going to be like content engineer, information developer, and like all those kinds of things. Those ones that have been under the surface and trying to be used, but all of a sudden they're going to come back because I think that in, and again, my opinion, not Heretta's opinion, but I think that the technical writer role is going to evolve quite a bit. And I'm, I hate what is happening with AI and the technical writing space specifically, but I think that there might be, there's always that pendulum swing. It goes one way and then it's going to come back the other. So I hope we come back the other sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really think it feels very short-sighted because we're not think or not we. They're not thinking about where is AI going to get its information from? Where's it getting the information from? Yes, it can write things, it can produce things, but there always needs to be a human in the loop. And if you don't have that, it's just a machine talking to another machine, building things for humans. I don't think that that is that it may work for maybe a month or two, but it won't be like that forever.
It
As
will break down.
as I say in the office, my the way the turntables.
Exactly. Okay, well, we are coming to the end of our time, and I want to be respectful of yours because you're doing lots of really cool big things. And but I always end our episodes with one question, and it is, if there was a hill you were willing to die on in technical documentation, what would that be?
Documentation is a product surface. It is not a support feature. That is my hill. I think that documentation needs to be respected in that way. And when you are releasing your product, the documentation needs to match the same level of intention, thoughtfulness that you put into the code that the engineers have written. And they work in tandem together, especially. Again, with the way that the industry is changing, it is very, very important to not lose sight of that.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I can't wait to stay in touch. This has been an awesome conversation.
Yes, thank you so much. I've had a great time speaking with you.
Great. Well, we'll definitely keep up and we'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Docs, where the content's structured, but the conversations aren't. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and share it with someone who loves great documentation as much as we do. Until next time, keep creating content that makes a difference.